Hi, I'm David Manti, and welcome to a new episode of the Today in Manufacturing podcast. With me this week are Jeff Ranke and Ben Munson. We each have more than 10 years of experience covering the manufacturing and design engineering industries. Every week, we take the five most popular stories on our websites and discuss the implications they have on the industry moving forward. Before we get started, please make sure to like, share, and subscribe to the podcast. You could also help us out a lot by leaving the podcast a positive review on whatever platform you use. If you want to email the podcast, you can reach any of us at Jeff, David, or Ben at IEN.com with email the podcast in the subject line. You could also subscribe to our daily newsletter. Make sure you get it delivered to your inbox first and subscribe on YouTube at IEN Magazine so you can join us when we go live, typically every Thursday at 2 or on the occasional Wednesday at 2:30, 2 p.m. But, you know, you get the notification either way. Jeff, how you doing?
Good. Shaking it up this week.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Ben, it's good to have you back.
Yeah, thanks. It's great to be here.
That was not convincing. Yeah.
You went with like full authority and then just kind of like, maybe it's not.
Yeah. Maybe. No, yeah, that's great. Yeah, right. This is fun. Right. Yeah.
Anna better be enjoying herself because I had to tag in. Well, it's good to have you. And Anna, we hope that you are enjoying your time at whatever destination you chose for spring break. All right. Before we get started with our first story, we have a word from our sponsor.
My name is Jeff Ranke. I'm the editorial director for Manufacturing.net, Industrial Equipment News, and Manufacturing Business Technology. I'll be joined by Dave McGovern and James Englehart from Office MDT to discuss various topics and provide takeaways on how you can be more efficient in the areas of OT data management control, version control, vulnerability protection, and much more. It's my pleasure to introduce Dave and Jim. Dave McGowan has 10 years of experience providing automation, change management, and disaster recovery solutions. He manages some of Office MDT's largest enterprise accounts and is especially passionate about helping customers implement the best OT backup and cybersecurity strategies. Jim Englehart has been working in the controls world for 35 years. He has a BS in both chemical engineering and electrical engineering and has worked in the refining and chemical, engineering consulting, and food and beverage areas before settling in as head of pre-sales engineering, professional services, and support for the Americas at Office MDT. He's also a member of the Office MDT product team.
And we're back. And just a reminder to go and watch The Secrets of OT Data Management, an exclusive new video podcast. Jeff, why should everyone drop what they're doing right now and go and watch this podcast?
After our podcast,
yes.
You should definitely go and download and watch this because it offers a lot of really interesting insights into, again, this whole digital transformation and a lot of things that can get overlooked. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of, you know, one of my favorite phrases, blocking and tackling.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Dot the I's, cross the T's, that kind of thing. And it can lead to much bigger issues if you don't take care of that right up front.
Mm-hmm. And it's not their fault because over the years, blocking and tackling has changed as to what you should be doing.
True. Very true.
Yes. You know, everyone's always looking for another podcast to add to the queue. So, hey, download this one. Now, our first story this week. Boeing sues Virgin Galactic over stalled mothership work. It's fair to say that Boeing is having a challenging year. And now it's dealing with yet another straw on the camel's back. According to Space News, Boeing and subsidiary Aurora Flight Sciences, that's the one working on all those X-planes, they've sued Richard Branson's commercial spacecraft company, Virgin Galactic. Apparently, Virgin Galactic refuses to pay $26.4 million that it owes Aurora and won't destroy proprietary information provided to the company. In 2022, Aurora agreed to handle manufacturing for the mothership, Virgin Galactic's high-altitude aircraft designed to carry a shuttle close to the edge of space. Aurora got through two task orders and then shut down work because it found out that it was going to be impossible to build a new mothership under Virgin's budget and timeline. It turns out that after Aurora left the project, Virgin also refused to part ways with Boeing trade secrets, referred to in the complaint as, quote, the equations. While it sounds ambiguous, the equations allow the plane makers to accurately model aircraft stability and control beyond what is commonly available in the aerospace industry. Aurora says it gives them a distinct competitive advantage. Virgin Galactic says its IP rights allow it to keep the records. But if the court sees it differently, then the company could be on the hook for damages in addition to that $26.4 million in unpaid invoices. It's going to be bad.
Yeah,
costly. Do you think Virgin Galactic, you know, has that in the coffers? Is that maybe why these bills are going unpaid?
Yeah, I think, I think the money is definitely secondary. It feels secondary in this dispute. Like Virgin Galactic right now is focused on developing its Delta class spaceships.
Mm-hmm.
And the company said it's on track to begin testing them next year and start commercial operations the year after, 2026. So they'll be in service by then, which is pretty soon.
Mm-hmm.
And once that happens, Virgin Galactic, they expect that each of its Delta-class ships will average about 8 space flights per month with 6 passengers, and that's $3.6 million in revenue per flight.
Okay, okay. Considerable.
Yeah, the company said it expects each spaceport will have a fleet of 4 to 5 spaceships and 2 motherships, enough assets to facilitate 300 to 400 space flights per year per spaceport. And at the high end of that guidance, that's more than $1.4 billion in revenue just from the space flights at each spaceport. So these new spaceships, they'll be a significant cash generator for Virgin Galactic in the near future. So it's kind of surprising to see the company flake out on $26 million in payments to Boeing, which seems like kind of small potatoes when you look at the big picture.
Right.
But I kind of think the unpaid invoices are not the most important part of the suit. And I think it comes down to the equations.
Yeah,
that
were, the equations.
Which sounds so cool. It's like you've stolen the equations. Yeah.
Yeah.
Sounds like maybe the worst name for a sequel movie ever.
Yeah. We've come
John
from the
Wick.
Equations.
The equations.
<Yeah. laughs> And these are clearly very valuable to Boeing as they laid out in their, you know, complaint. And I'm thinking that they'd also be really prized by Virgin Galactic as well, because, you know, when there's so much money at stake and they're talking about commercial service and passengers are going to be paying, you know, huge amounts of money to travel on these ships. And so being able to have a safe and stable operation is going to be paramount for them. And it's easy to see that kind of business model falling apart if, you know, if Virgin Galactic can't provide a smooth, you know, space flight, who's going to want to do that?
Yeah. Well, and I agree. That's one of the things is like, okay, I get it. They had access to your trade secrets, but they already do. You know, like you said, burn them, and they said, nah. And I mean, I don't know how you, I guess, claw back intellectual property, right? Like, I mean, what can't you get back into? I can't think of the saying right now. You can't get whatever back into the thing. What's the receptacle?
The toothpaste.
You can't get the toothpaste back in the tube. Thank you.
If somebody tells you to destroy records and you don't want to do it, just say, yeah, okay.
Yeah. You completely.
Ben Munson advocating trade theft.
Like, yep, we burnt them.
Yeah.
Yep, it's all good.
It turns out, I mean, we got rid of all the records. It turns out that the three engineers that had them, they committed everything to their photographic memory. Sorry, they just can't get rid of that.
Like, if you want, I don't advocate stealing these trade secrets, but if you're going to do it, say, okay.
I agree with you. Like, and what
you agree with?
Well, I do
agree with the right. There's a right way to steal things, man.
Well,
come on.
So there are a couple of red flags for me here, right? Like, so
a couple.
I thought that this intellectual property was handed over as part of their agreement that they had, right? But it was handed over inadvertently, and they decided not to give it back or destroy it. I mean, maybe that was like the first red flag that, hey, maybe this partnership isn't going to work out. Like, hey, we emailed you everything that you needed. A couple of extra things in there, too, if you could just delete those attachments. Again, they could have just so easily said, like, yep, did it. Instead, they're just, I mean, but to their point, they argue that they have rights to these documents as part of their agreement. So it's kind of like they're stuck in a he said, she said sort of argument right now. Jeff, it's crazy to me that we have large aerospace companies like Virgin Galactic and Boeing kind of trifling a bit about $26 million. But another thing that stands out is like, this is for like preliminary design work on the aircraft. You know, they did two tasks and that was worth $26.4 million. It's crazy to think what the entire contract actually would have been.
Yeah.
But I don't know. It's surprising to me that this has come to such a hit.
Well, it doesn't mean when you talk about proprietary information like this, I guess it doesn't surprise me. And I agree with Ben. I think the financial elements here, even though there's some interesting sort of, if you want to connect some dots, there is some stuff you can look at there.
Yeah.
But I think the IP is obviously the most important part of this. And I think even though they're calling it equations, I think the outcome here would show like obvious trade secret theft.
Yeah. You're
talking about aircraft stability and things like that they've sort of pioneered, or Boeing feels like they pioneered and was being implemented here. I think they'd be able to tell if they were using basically what Boeing supplied. So I think Virgin's being forthcoming and protecting themselves potentially further down the line as well if they want to continue to use these algorithms and equations and all this other fun math stuff that you could understand, but I would never be able to really grasp.
Easily, like I mean, wouldn't even need a piece of paper. It would just like easily come to the answer in my brain.
Yeah,
just it's all about them second apples. Natures. That's right. All about them apples. Well, so the other thing is that another document that they say they believe is there, they have a right to have, is test data on some new or composite material that they have as well. And that's another thing that they specifically said, like, no. And it's going to be interesting to see how vague that agreement is. Like, a lot of times they're like made vague for this type of interpretation. Yeah. And I don't know. Interesting to see how they would rule on this.
I don't think this is going to go away. And here's why. You can use the $26 million as sort of a, I don't know, almost a disguise or an illusion or a distraction, I guess you could say, to get at this IP, because there's other factors involved here. First of all, Virgin Galactic has about $1 billion in the coffers, but they're losing a lot of money, like $100 million or more right now per year. And they haven't really even started firing off the big stuff yet. So, but one of the ways that they have been able to at least generate some revenue is because they have been doing some cargo deliveries and other things with the current aircraft that they do have.
Yeah.
So if you're Boeing and you're seeing that they are bringing in some revenue, and Boeing also has this subsidiary called United Launch Alliance, which that's what they want to do as well. And then you see a potential competitor basically using your technology to perform the same service that you want to perform.
Yeah.
I could see how you get touchy about that.
Yeah.
I mean, even though right now it's not to scale and it's not a huge factor from a competitive perspective, I get it. I mean, if you work at ULA and you're seeing Galactic doing this stuff and maybe taking a contract or two away from you, yeah, get after them. I would do the same thing. So I think it's interesting when you see that. Plus, with the fact that Virgin Galactic only has about $1 billion in cash and marketable assets, they're also in a push. They have these new aircraft coming out, but they've only got about 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And that's about the time lane that would run out of money here when it comes to developing all these new aircraft. So there's a lot of interesting moving parts. I could also appreciate some folks at Boeing going, hey, this is kind of a nice distraction from all the other garbage we're dealing with. Let's really pump some energy into this and try to get a win out of it.
Yeah, it was kind of cool to run a Boeing story that wasn't like, look what Boeing did.
we're Boeing's the victim.
Yeah, like just like way to go, Boeing. Yeah, like at least they come out a little bit, looking a little bit better in this one.
Giving them a little bit of compassion.
Yeah, although they did hand over a lot of proprietary information inadvertently. Did they like leave the briefcase like in the meeting room?
See, I can see that though, because we even do this. Okay, there are certain assets that we will rent out. Okay, to people with the understanding that this will be destroyed. This isn't something you're going to use long term. So I think that's not that uncommon.
Yeah.
When you do have suppliers working together like this, so I get it.
So which one looks worse, Jeff? Like, is it a bigger stain on Boeing if they accidentally attached two pieces of proprietary IP, or that, you know, kind of they were taken for a ride by Virgin Galactic?
I think, and this is going to sound ridiculous, but isn't there some sort of like gentleman's agreement here? Like Virgin Galactic, if you weren't supposed to get this, to Ben's point, delete it. It's not like you can erase things from your memory.
Yeah.
I mean, be
See,
smart.
You turned them. You turned him. Jeff's
No.
Jeff's on team just like, just say it's gone.
He's officially pro theft.
Yep, no, shred and deny.
I say get rid of it, but there's only some things. I mean, like you said, can't get rid of memory. I mean.
All right. Our next most popular story. GM is reimbursing buyers who overpaid for the new Blazer EV. The Chevy Blazer was a known brand GM redesigned from the ground up for the electric market. Unfortunately, the highly anticipated rollout that started last year has had some problems. The company even issued a temporary stop sale on the Blazer EVs. After GM spent months fixing multiple issues like software bugs and charging problems, and when the stop sale was lifted, GM cut the price by up to $6,500. But it didn't leave early adopters in the lurch. For example, the team at Edmunds bought a Blazer EV back in December. They had the same problems as others, but the repairs seemed to be working. They paid roughly $60,000 for a Blazer that now retails for about $55,000. Important comma there. What is most notable is that GM offered to reimburse them for the difference, offering some $5,600. GM has plans to release its highly anticipated Equinox electric SUV later this year. Jeff, is this a sign of good faith for potential buyers, not just for the Equinox, but of the Blazer going forward?
I think there's a couple of different positive things we can look at here. First of all, kind of an out-of-the-box approach mm-hmm. by GM. I mean, this is not something traditionally they've been good at,
yeah.
which is responding to a problem in a really positive way, which I think they did here. The one thing, too, it's kind of interesting. I mean, the $6,500 in this instance, these types of things really aren't that uncommon. It's just usually they're done at the time of the sale. You know, we talked about these cash rebates. There are some huge cash rebates out there for EVs right now. I think the F-150's got like a $12,000 cash rebate right now if you buy a new one. So it's cool that they kind of did that retroactively to mm-hmm. go back and do this. What's really interesting to me is looking at that Edmunds article and the 23 different codes that popped up once they plugged it in. Now, when you see 23 codes come up, you know, these are the equivalent of all the lights on the dashboard.
Yeah.
And a lot of them didn't display. But when you look more closely at them, what it really was, it wasn't mechanical failures other than like the infotainment system. I mean, that was horked up six ways from Sunday.
So bad.
That was terrible. But a lot of it was like the sensors and the modules basically not reading data correctly. Not trying to excuse that or minimize it, but for me, it was in an odd way almost reassuring because it wasn't a mechanical issue.
Yeah.
Putting windows down, that's important. I'm not trying to say it's not.
It's not mission critical, though.
You could still safely operate the vehicle just in a very confusing way because of all of the ridiculous feedback you are getting. So in a way, you know, I think GM can spin this very positively in terms of it was put out there. We didn't have these things squared away, but none of it was mechanical, and we got it right. Edmunds even came out and said, yeah, the car's been working great since we got it back from the factory. The other thing I was just going to point out too is I think this really sort of illustrates a lot of things we've been talking about with EVs and the rush to get to market. And there's so much pressure to get something out there. I'd like to say this was a couple of things being overlooked, but obviously there was some major issues in terms of the data and communication system here.
It's crazy that you could get those types of errors after driving it off the lot. And just out of sheer chance, you should have been able to catch at least half of these, right? You're right. The diagnostics check revealed 23 codes. None of them showed up on the dashboard, or as my dad likes to refer to as the idiot lights.
Idiot lights, yeah.
Which actually, this would have given me great deniability as a driver if this happened to me. But I mean, okay, when Edmunds talked about the specific problems here, right? They were actually attending a media event for the Blazer EV. The windows didn't work. The infotainment display became stuck in an infinite loop of shutting off and turning on. And the GPS just displayed the map in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. So, I mean, when you're heading... Ben, when you're heading to a Blazer EV promotional event, that's not a good experience to have going into it. Just like, hey, I'm ready for the Q&A. I have some questions.
Yeah, I think it was Edmunds and Inside EVs. They both reviewed it, and they both reported the same kind of huge list of problems. And credit to GM for putting in like the huge amount of work that they had to do to get the Blazer EV back on the road. Inside EVs, they interviewed, Barris Seatonak, who is GM's vice president of product software and services. And he said the team was logging as much as 16,000 miles a day to test the driving conditions and charging and other aspects of the vehicle.
This is before or after that?
That was after. After the stop sale to kind of get everything back in working order. And yeah, I mean, you guys have already talked about the reviews, like the infotainment screen going dark is awful.
Yeah.
And because that would severely limit the use of a lot of onboard features, I'm sure. But in their review too, their reviewer, the vehicle bricked entirely while they were trying to fast charge it.
Oh, man.
They needed to have it towed away because I don't think they could even get back inside of it.
Whoa.
It just locked up. So, I mean, these are serious issues.
Yeah. Maybe put the 16,000 miles in a day before it goes to market.
Yeah, and it kind of makes the credit, the $6,000 credit, seem a little, you know, short of what maybe should have been warranted in this situation. Maybe a full refund. I don't know. Like, if my car locks me out and then I have to pay to get it towed away, I'm going to be upset.
Hopefully they covered the tow as part of the recall.
Yeah.
Although I know how difficult it is to actually get reimbursed for any sort of recall, regardless of how trivial, over it. I thought $5,600, like that's something where if they reached out, that's a significant amount of money, mm-hmm. you know, because in your mind you've already spent it and maybe you kind of get, like you said, Ben, maybe you have it in your mind that, oh my goodness, I paid 60 grand for like a lemon, you know,
yeah.
It'd be, at least help ease that a little bit. And it applies to anyone who bought a new Blazer EV before March 7th of this year. Mm-hmm. So, it includes a lot of people.
Yeah, I think now that the car is working well for everybody, I'm sure that money feels like a nice bonus. But, you know, the people that did buy it early, like last year, have been dealing with a lot of headaches for a long time.
I mean, speaking of headaches, like having no infotainment system while taking a long drive across the state with colleagues, like, I mean, that could go bad. That could go bad. Just like all of a sudden, like you're 2/3 of the way in and politics start coming out and you're like, we're not going to do it. We're not going to do it.
Yeah. I might be dating myself here, but when I was reading this, did anybody else have thoughts or flashbacks when you get like a cassette tape stuck in the car radio?
Yeah.
Maybe I'm too old to.
Or not stuck. Well, yeah. It's,
it was stuck and it would repeat or be that. Click, 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 click,
the clicking sound. It would get stuck, because it was trying to eject it.
Both ways.
Yeah. I mean,
you'd have like the worst possible music choice in there that would just get stuck on.
Yeah. You know? Or you would, it just chewed the tape. Like you would pull it out and like just the reams of tape.
I think the last tape we ever put in the car was the one that like allowed you to plug in the CD player.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Which was great technology. It was like you could listen to CDs through a tape.
At the time, it was incredible because I was driving like an 87 Maxima and I was just like, as long as that Discman kept playing, I was good.
Yeah.
You know? You're still chewing through like 5 or 6 batteries, you know, while you're on a 3-hour
trip. I had a tape get stuck pulling into the high school parking lot playing House of Pain. That was a good one.
There you go.
That's dope.
according to Jalopnik, and I just wanted to share this because it kind of very succinctly puts how they felt about this particular vehicle. While I am glad to see that Chevy dropped the price of the Blazer EV, I still think it's a big price to pay for a midsize crossover that's riddled with GM's signature cheap, scratchy plastics. Aside from questionable materials, high price, and terrible software, the Blazer EV is still a comfortable, powerful, and spacious electric crossover. And I was just like, man, for anybody who stayed to the end, worth it. Where they're just like, hey, if you can get past the cheap interior and the software that doesn't work and the incredible cost, you got yourself a heck of a car.
Winner.
Yeah. All right. Our next most popular story. Tyson targeting immigrants and refugees for factory jobs. According to Bloomberg, Tyson Foods is looking to refugees and immigrants to fill some roles that place cuts into trays, inspect for bones, and wash meat. The food processor has some 100,000 people working and working on this. An associate director of human resources, Garrett Dolan, says the company turns over about 40% of workers in these jobs every year. So Tyson needs to hire 52,000 people in 2024 just to keep pace. Bloomberg says that Tyson hired 17 immigrants seeking asylum from Mexico, Colombia, and Venezuela last month to work at its plant in Tennessee. The company also hired 70 more asylum seekers. In 2022, Tyson committed to hiring 2,500 refugees across 3 years in the United States. The company also committed $1.5 million to provide free citizenship and legal services for immigrant team members. This month, Tyson announced plans to cut 1,200 workers and close an Iowa pork plant. Talked about it on the podcast last week, maybe the week before. Last August, the company said it would cease operations at 4 U.S. chicken plants and shift production to other facilities. Well, all of this has people quite fired up, and some are calling for boycotts because Tyson is, quote, hiring migrant workers while firing American workers. In a statement, Tyson called the accusations, quote, misinformation, and said any insinuation that we would cut American jobs to hire immigrant workers is completely false. Jeff, have you had a chance to follow this story? Because how the narrative has been manipulated and how some potentially good programs at Bloomberg really came to bite them a little bit, let's say. And, you know, some, let's just say they said he misspoke, but, you know, having an HR rep out there say, giving figures that maybe aren't as factual. I don't know. Tyson seems to be like the next person that people are trying, or the next company that people are trying to cancel.
So first of all, I just want to make sure I'm understanding this correctly. They're saying they're going to bring in 2,500 people over the next 3 years.
Yeah. So this is a separate program. They say within the next 3 years, I can't remember what was the specific name of the program, but yes, they were going to bring in, they committed to bringing in 2,500 refugees across the next 3 years. And kind of a point of contention there was the $1.5 million that they were going to provide in legal services. And
sure. Okay. So they've got 50,000 open jobs.
Yeah.
They're going to use this program to fill 2,500 of them.
Yes. Yes. But people were kind of.
No, I understand.
Yep.
I'm trying to offer some common sense here.
Yeah.
Part of this, if you're really frustrated about what Tyson is doing here, then stop complaining about rising food prices. Mm-hmm. Okay. The reality is this. These are not easily recruitable jobs. If you've ever been in a plant floor on a poultry processing facility, it's not glamorous. It's important work. It's hard work. It's difficult. And it has a vital role in our society. Okay. We need people doing this work. But when you're looking and comparing this to other manufacturing jobs, it's a tough sell.
Yeah.
It just is. And the reality is these have also been traditionally lower paying jobs. Mm-hmm. And we've been through all this before. It's because food processing in particular has very, very tight margins. So now, post pandemic, companies were, in a lot of instances, forced to raise the hourly wage for these positions. Right now, we're looking at a lot of these, and I'm looking at the state of Wisconsin just to use as a good example. In the state of Wisconsin, Tyson average pay for these types of positions is about $40,000 a year. That's $20 an hour. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's according to the latest BLS stats from 2022. Now, that's great, but the livable wage is also $20 an hour.
Yeah.
So again, if you're going to try to struggle to find people to fill these positions, you've got a wage that's been set because nobody wants to pay more. We've experienced the blowback that we saw when chicken prices went up. There's this dichotomy where something's got to give. You need to put product out. You've gotten a certain wage that's been established, and it's higher than it has been in recent years. If manufacturing workers here don't want those jobs, which is fine,
yeah,
because you're competing with other manufacturers, you have to find a workforce someplace. Mm-hmm. And this is what Tyson is doing. So I don't have a problem with them doing it. If we don't want this to happen, instead of boycotting companies, stop complaining about higher prices. Mm-hmm. This is sort of the cycle we're in right now. The one thing that I will, and I said this last week when we had the story about the plant shutting down, is if you want to blame Tyson for everything, it was poor forecasting.
Yeah.
They thought the pricing model was going to hang steady for a long time. It didn't. Mm-hmm. And as a result, people lost jobs. That sucks. Mm-hmm. But it's also part of this new vicious economy that we're trying to figure out right now. Don't blame Tyson for trying to find a different way to bring people into work at their facilities to get product out the door.
Well, and another thing that's kind of irresponsible is the provocateurs in the media landscape that basically see this story and then reframe it to make it seem like Tyson is following buses as they're dropping people off, right, picking them up, bringing them to Tennessee, and paying for them to become a citizen, essentially. Ben, did you have a chance to follow this story at all? Just because once it caught fire, I'll admit, like, I got caught up because I just read a couple of blurbs about it. And I was just like, wait a second. So they just fired all these people, and in turn, they're going after all these refugees and asylum seekers. But, you know, sometimes, as we've seen many, many times in this industry before and every other industry, is that sometimes, you know, you got to read past that second paragraph to really understand what's fully going on here.
Yeah, it seemed like the story was off and running really quickly. And I did follow it. I think the aspect that really kind of blew me away was the turnover rate that they were talking about, that their HR rep was talking about. I didn't think that chicken processing would be a job that people would want to do for like a super long time. Mm-hmm. But the amount of positions that they need to fill. Is this on an annual basis then too?
That's
50,000.
So that's what they said. But there's a little bit more context in that. Like, according to the AP, who wanted to follow up, especially with some fact checking after these kind of caught fire, and then, you know, we're playing telephone with facts here, right? So according to the AP, a spokesperson said, quote, the company has no current plans to hire 52,000 workers in the U.S. But that said, Tyson says that anywhere from 5 to 8% of jobs are open at its 500 U.S. locations at any given time. Mm-hmm. So while it might not be 52,000 specifically that they're trying to fill every year at this one particular plant.
Yeah.
They're always looking for warm bodies.
Yeah. That's a huge amount of people. And you hit it on the head. It is not fun work. I don't know if you guys have ever done anything close to meat processing.
Yeah. I've done it only myself. Like, we've butchered chickens before, and I've seen how to butcher 6 chickens, and that was enough for me to say, probably don't ever want to do that again.
I have a visual from going to the poultry expo down in Atlanta. It's a show every year. Big, you know, that's where all of the suppliers go to show off the latest technology that they have for processing chickens. And there was an individual there. They're called deboning equipment. Mm-hmm. And basically it's a handheld tool. It's got a spinning edge on it. Yeah. That they used to take the meat off the bone. And that guy was demonstrating those products for like 3 days.
Yeah.
And if you saw him on the last day he was there, he was about done.
Yeah.
Okay. And that's 3 days on a trade show floor, not, you know, 40 hours a week in a processing plant. So it is hard work. Mm-hmm. But again, it's important stuff. And the more people we can find to do it, the better.
And regarding the 1,200 in Iowa, the offer was still on the table that they could fill roles at other plants, which we know. I mean, sometimes we talk about that, and the manufacturer has maybe like one or two other plants in disparate parts of the United States. Tyson has 500. So, I mean, there is a chance that they could potentially stay in the Tyson family. I know that, as we talked about before, it is hard to uproot your family. You got kids in school. That's not really a likely scenario for most people. However, Tyson also said, most importantly, that these roles, the 5 to 8% across 500 factories, are available to anyone who's qualified and legally authorized to work in the United States. That said, they also mentioned that they're strongly opposed to illegal immigration. They said that in a statement. But I mean, I thought that the company, especially in the follow-up, did a really good job of being plain spoken, just like, hey, we've got roles to fill, and if you can legally work, we're looking at you, you know? Tyson also said that approximately 42,000 of its current U.S. employees are non-citizens with work authorization. 42,000 out of, I think it's 120,000. Mm-hmm. Now, again, I kind of mentioned it as I was like stumbling through my words at the end of that. But according to Dyson, the HR representative Dolan, quote, misspoke. The other thing that stood out to me was that, Ben, I don't know if you noticed this too, but like they said, this is just another boycott over woke policies. But like this isn't woke. Yeah. Like no part of this is like the woke argument. I was just like, okay, hold on a second. If the outrage is going to get boiling and we're going to boycott it, at least boycott it for the right reasons. Don't just say go woke, go broke. That don't make any sense. Like not going woke. That was, I don't know. That stood out to me. And I'm just like, now hold on a minute here.
Now Tyson said that this is a boycott over woke.
Policy. No. That was like a industry analyst saying that, okay. Oh, yet another boycott. Well, it saying that's why people were saying they were boycotting because All the people on Twitter were like...
And I think if something lands in the vicinity of a hot button issue, all of a sudden it becomes woke and it becomes a divisive thing, you know, where, you in their mind, maybe they're picturing, you know, the Tyson executives, you know, at the border, letting people through. Like, you come in, we got chickens, we got to, you know, process.
Just like a Tyson branded bus that they just walk onto. Yeah. But that even in the, if that was the case, that's not woke. All right.
Yeah. Weird comment.
No, it was I don't know. It's just I get it. You know, you're not necessarily looking for common sense during like social media outrage. And like I just wanted that to be the hill to die on. Just like now, hold on a second. This is not woke. Just to see the blowback on Twitter or X on that one. All right. Our next most popular story. Boeing CEO to step down amid shakeup following 737 MAX blowout. Boeing CEO David Calhoun is stepping down at the end of the year. The move is part of a management shakeup that will also see Stan Deal, president and CEO of Boeing's commercial airplanes unit, retire immediately. Board chairman Lawrence Kellner will also be replaced. Boeing has been on the hot seat for a while now, and the FAA recently gave the company's 737 factory failing grades on nearly three dozen aspects of production. Airlines aren't happy either because of the microscope the incidents have put the industry under. Calhoun, who is 67, called the recent Alaska Airlines blowout, that's where the door fell off, a, quote, watershed moment for Boeing. That requires, quote, a total commitment to safety and quality at every level of our company. I guess part of that commitment is his departure. Calhoun said the decision to leave was his. Previous filings show that Calhoun received compensation valued at more than $64.6 million from 2020 through 2022. Almost all of it was in the form of stock awards, options, and bonuses. Now, the company tapped former Qualcomm CEO Stephen Mollenkopf to as the new board chairman. He's going to lead the search for Calhoun's replacement. Stephanie Pope, the company's COO with less than 3 months of experience, took over the commercial airplanes unit. The 51-year-old was promoted to COO in January. Before that, she was president and CEO of Boeing's service businesses. Jeff, Boeing has lost more than $23 billion since Calhoun took over, and admittedly some of that is him taking over after the 737 crash accidents, but part of me thinks that maybe him staying through the end of the year is a little less him giving time to find a replacement and them saying, hey, we're going to compensate you well, and we're piling everything on as you're going out the door.
Well, it'd be difficult not to. Mm-hmm. I mean, when you're at the head of the ship, that's just part of the deal.
Yeah.
When you look at this, I think that to me, this was the first time where you kind of saw Boeing in a panic. Usually they've been pretty calm and collective in responding to everything that's been going on. And these are some pretty dramatic moves. One that caught my eye too is Stephanie Pope being promoted. This is her eighth promotion since 2012. She's a finance person. Mm-hmm. Now, I understand they brought her in because she was working with the airlines. And right now, it's basically, let's just stop the bleeding. Let's preserve these relationships that we have with these airlines and with also, I think, the military or the defense side of things as well, which I can appreciate. But then when they talk about one of the analysts also talking about the leading candidate being the current president and CEO of Spirit AeroSystems, which might be the main issue here to begin with.
Yeah.
That one kind of threw me.
Yeah.
If you're going out and you're getting a new board from Qualcomm and looking into the semiconductor industry, which is outside, has some obviously connections to aerospace, but from a different industry, I think that's where they might be going as well in terms of filling the CEO role, which would make a lot of sense because you need somebody who understands quality. You need somebody who understands production and getting things out the door in a safe manner and really rebuilding confidence in this company, not from really from passengers, but from their customers and other suppliers. So it's going to be interesting to see how this is filled. I'm going to go on a limb and say they'll have this position filled before the end of the year.
Yeah.
I don't think they're going to need their current CEO to ride it out that much longer.
Well, I mean, he'll just hang out in the background and the new CEO will make a decision. And if, maybe if it doesn't work out, they'll just be like, oh, actually, that was Calhoun. Yeah. Just like, hey, hold on a second. It's a big golden parachute. We're not going to weigh it down too much. Jack, who's joining us live. Jack, we don't worry. It does okay that you're late. We're happy to see you here. And you're right. Let's go. Jeff, so are you talking about Patrick Shanahan?
Yeah.
Shanahan. Yeah, Patrick Shanahan. Nefarious name that must not be trusted. Producer Alex's last name is Alex Shanahan. He can shut it down. He's got his hand on the red button.
I'll pull the plug right now.
So that seemed a little weird to me, right? Like, so it was Richard Abulafia, a consultant at Aerodynamic Advisory. He said the management shakeup, quote, is likely to be a pivotal moment in Boeing's history and probably a very positive one. And I was just like, well, I mean, that's great that you would think that because, I mean, it's going to be hard for it to be worse, right? And Ben, the other thing is that, yeah, to Jeff's point, he named Patrick Shanahan, a former Boeing executive and acting U.S. Defense Secretary under the Trump administration, who has led Spirit AeroSystems since last fall. I mean, he said that would be a, quote, great choice. I don't know, based off of everything we've heard about Spirit AeroSystems, I don't know if that would be a great choice.
Yeah, I don't know. I agree that could be a bad choice. There's a lot of options floating around out there right now, and it seems like the next CEO, whether it's permanent or interim, needs to have a good understanding of the operational side of Boeing's business.
Agreed.
And I was reading in Fortune today, one of the names that they had mentioned was was Boeing's former CFO, Greg Smith. And they said he had worked for the company, you know, 3 decades, and he was extremely popular across the company. And even though, you know, he's the chief financial officer, he had demonstrated a pretty good grasp of everything that Boeing is doing from the ground up.
I mean, that would help with morale.
Yeah. Whoever they choose, though, it just does seem like Boeing needs to turn things around really quickly because it's burning through cash, like a couple billion. You know, this quarter,
yeah,
just because of the production slowdowns and the, I guess the company was reportedly due to meet with major airlines this week. It was in the AP last week, and they had even mentioned that Calhoun was not going to be at those meetings, which was kind of a hint.
Need to meet with him. Don't worry about it.
The leaders of those airlines, they've been vocal before, vocal critics of what's going on at Boeing. They didn't comment for this story, but I think we should watch what they have to say in the coming months, because if they can chime in with like a vote of confidence, that might be one of the best indicators of improvements at Boeing. I think if it's coming from them, then that really means something.
Yeah, it might help ease them a little bit. I didn't mean to throw Mr. Shanahan under a bus here, but it just seemed odd to me that they talked to an industry analyst and he's just like, you know who's the man for the job? This guy, maybe my friend. I'm not certain. Maybe I get 20% of it. It just seemed like, I'm going to throw a name out there. I don't know. I think the next CEO should be Jeff Franke. Just like.
So do you think they should go with somebody within the industry or outside?
No, I think they should go with someone from in the industry with manufacturing or engineering experience. That's just my own personal take. But also experience in a leadership role there. I don't know much about Greg Smith. It seems like he could potentially fit the bill.
And he doesn't technically count as an internal hire since he retired, I think, in 2022. Yeah. He's still on American Airlines board.
Okay.
So he's been right there to watch all of this kind of unfold.
Well, I'm going to go on record. They need to go outside of aerospace.
You think so?
I do.
Where, when they went to the Qualcomm guy, that stood out to you as like, okay, that.
I think it's a good move. It puts a better perspective on this. You're not just doing things the same way you've always done them.
Oh, gotcha. I guess when I thought operationally, because when you've seen interviews with people on the operations and manufacturing side of it, they've voiced concerns, right? Yeah. Like they know we're not doing it, I guess, for lack of a better term, the Boeing way that we've always done since our founding. I don't want like manufacturing yes person. Just like, oh, the guy that's been rubber stamping everything we're doing. Let's get him in. And talking about the billions, Ben, last week, Boeing CFO said the company burned between $4 billion and $4.5 billion more in cash than it expected in the first quarter because it slowed down airplane production after the Alaska Airlines accident. That is a lot.
Yeah.
Significant.
That's a big hit.
I mean, when you're the CFO and you're just working on putting those numbers in the spreadsheet, just like three more zeros in the loss. I know the cash reserves got to be all right, but.
Yeah, you don't have to be a CFO to know that that's bad. He's like, in a lot of ways, my job's pretty easy right now. Like, this is bad.
It's just one column. Everything's going into the same column.
Yeah, as you can see here, everything's bad.
Yeah. Right? The red column's pretty heavy right now, guys. Producer Eric, who is joining us live from parts unknown in the United States, says, looking and sounding good, great over here, guys. Hello. And a hello to you too, Producer Eric. Hope you're having a good time. Hopefully no one's eaten too much sand. Did anyone else see that one? Apparently some members of the family are sampling sand. And I mean, why?
That's a bold move.
I understand every once in a while you fall in the sand and you taste it, but you never like knowingly grab it and eat it.
Are they eating handfuls?
I mean, it was like, there was quite a bit. There was like a sand mustache.
Mm-hmm.
It was just like, all right. Okay.
Yeah, they're going to regret that.
To each their own. I guess. Yeah. Maybe
they're going to regret that.
It'll be like the next castor oil or something. Just like, you know what cleans you out? Handfuls of beach sand.
Yeah.
Specifically American beach sand. All right. Our most popular story this week. Lucid must change illegal severance agreements. Late last March, Lucid Motor announced plans to cut about 18% of the company's staff. Some 1,800 workers. The company had problems getting its electric vehicles off the line and onto the road. A few former employees filed unfair labor practice charges against the manufacturer for language found in Lucid's severance agreements. They accused the company of offering severance agreements with illegal provisions that prevented or discouraged workers from exercising their right to engage in activities protected by the National Labor Relations Act. Last week, the NLRB, or the National Labor Relations Board, announced a settlement approved on March 5th of this year that forces the EV maker to walk back some of that language used in those severance agreements. As part of the settlement, Lucid must revise its severance agreement and remove overly broad confidentiality provisions. The company can't enforce the provision, and it must post a notice about employee rights at the Newark, California facility. Lucid also has to email the notice to all current employees as well as those who were laid off. Jeff, I wanted to get your thoughts because to me, it seems like these severance agreements have become more and more restrictive in terms of like, hey, we're going to give you a good severance, but you have to essentially give up all basic rights to receive those. And you can't, I mean, a lot of times these come down to like, you cannot say one disparaging thing about this company on social media or as a review, they could come back and get it.
Yeah. And this is where you just wish there was more common sense applied to some of these agreements, because anybody who listens to this podcast knows I am not a fan of government getting more involved in private sector and getting involved in business and telling you how to run your enterprise. But in this situation, this was almost like a reverse form of blackmail or something here. Is the way that this read to me, which is just wrong. And it's good that there is a government institution that can get involved and basically slap people's hands and say, you can't do this.
Yeah.
You went too far.
Yeah.
And what it really, to me, it sort of shines a light on the whole NLRB, because we ran another article this week talking about a number of bigger companies like Amazon, SpaceX, and others that are saying that NLRB is unconstitutional. Mm-hmm. And the article is actually really good. It lays out a history of everything and why the board was established and what it's done over time. And in my opinion, there are some instances where the NLRB gets too involved.
Yeah.
And there are instances where it needs to be involved more, like this one.
Yeah.
Now, this has been settled. This situation is done. Lucid learned their lesson, hopefully, and so did others, ideally.
Yeah.
But if we're going to continue to have this conversation about, does the National Labor Relations Board need to be there? Is it a constitutional entity? All of those types of things. I think if you don't want it involved, just do the right thing, man.
Yeah.
Like, don't go so far. If you want to put some sort of measures in place when you're giving people a severance payment, which maybe you're not authorized, you don't have to do, you're not mandated to do, just make it reasonable.
Yeah.
Just say, hey, look, if you're going to do this stuff, give us a chance to talk back. Give us a chance to comment. Let us know if you're going to talk to somebody. Something. I don't even know if that's even fair.
Yeah.
But just put something in place so that you're not coming across as the bad guy. You're not basically forcing people to take these severances and sign away things that they wouldn't normally do. And what does speaking illy of the company mean? Does that mean if you're in an interview for your next job and they say, well, why didn't it work out? And you said, well, they really didn't manage their money very well. Is that slander? Can they come after you for your severance package? I mean, where does it stop and start?
Yeah.
And that's why you have the Labor Relations Board getting so heavily involved in a lot of these situations where they shouldn't be needed.
Yeah.
And it all comes back to the manufacturer using a little common sense.
Mm-hmm.
And like you always like to say is, you know, we can't have nice things, right?
Yeah.
Don't break stuff so easily.
Yeah.
Just be a person about it.
Yeah. I mean, that's what I thought too, is like, you know, you have the NLRB not to legislate business, but to just help retain basic workers' rights, right? And SpaceX, you mentioned, they're accused of doing the same thing, requiring laid off and fired workers to sign these unlawful agreements that bar them from disparaging the company and joining class action lawsuits against it. Jeff, I mean, the thing that stood out for me was, you know, whatever happened to just like, that's a disgruntled former employee? You know, like, I mean, everyone I feel like has had a moment where they've read a Glassdoor or an Indeed review from a former or a prospective company, and you can tell, like, that's a disgruntled former employee.
Yeah.
That's an HR rep. That's an HR rep. That's a disgruntled employee. You know, and it's just, I don't know. To me, we've gotten a little beyond the point of just like you said, common sense, right? Ben, is that too much to ask for a little common sense, you know, when we're executing these severance agreements? Or is it just that companies have gotten away kind of incrementally taking a little bit more each time that, you know, finally they went too far?
Yeah. And I think it lacks a little bit of foresight, some of these agreements, barring employees from disparaging, your company. It seems to kind of invoke the Streisand effect.
Mm-hmm.
If you guys
don't remember this,
about 20 years ago, a photographer took a picture of Barbara Streisand's mansion in Malibu to try to show the effects of coastal erosion. And Streisand sued to try and block the photo's release. And her actions ended up making the story a lot bigger than it likely would have been originally. I think prior to her getting involved, maybe 5 or 6 people had viewed this photo on the internet.
Yeah.
And after she got involved and tried to block it, it went up to something like 500,000 views. People had gone and looked at this photo. Yeah. And so it's like, bottom line, it's like, if you're worried about your employees disparaging your company after they leave, it probably just means that there are internal problems that should be addressed.
Yeah. That's a good
point. Trying to shut them up, it will only make it worse. I mean, because look, now Lucid is on our podcast in front of the entire world. and everything they tried to cover up is right here in plain sight.
Yeah. If you're right. Our global audience,
mm-hmm.
they're all hearing it now.
Yep.
Yep. They're on their radar.
We're blowing it wide open and there's nothing they can do about it. And it's all because they tried to stifle, you know, their former employees with these, with these agreements that, I think are unlawful.
And it really, when we talk about a toxic culture or culture problems at a company, it is things like this that are real red flags for, I mean, not just employees, but anyone that's looking to do business with a company, mm-hmm. especially with a company like Lucid that is, you know, depending on the month, hanging yeah. on for dear life already, yeah, you know? Yeah. I don't know, Ben, maybe they're going like, hey, we're just getting our name in the headlines. Yeah. No news or all news is good news. Yeah. We need to get on the Today in Manufacturing podcast so more people know about yeah, the Lucid EVs.
Got another Google alert for Lucid. We're killing it.
A little bit more background on this. So this goes back to February 2023, where the NLRB issued McLaren McComb, which reinstated this longstanding precedent that says employers that offer workers severance agreements that require them to broadly waive their rights is a violation of the National Labor Relations Act. The decision actually involved agreements that prohibited furloughed employees from making these disparaging statements about their employer or disclosing the severance agreement's terms. And again, that's another thing, like, pretty much, I mean, I get it. You want to try and, like, I guess, cut down the chatter, like, worker to worker to see who got what. But, like, by doing that, you're just, like, poking the bear a little bit in terms of, like, I mean, like, when you, I mean, maybe it's just, like, a personal failing, but, like, when you tell me I can't do something, that is the first thing I want to do. Mm-hmm. And just, like, wait, I cannot share the terms of this? Well, all right. Sounds good to me. I'll just walk out of here and nothing will happen. Yeah. Should be fine. In a March 2023 memo, Jennifer Abruzzo, the NLRB general counsel, said that severance agreements that force people to forfeit their statutory rights to receive severance benefits, violates the law. Comes down. It's that simple. And finally, you know, they made a change.
Right.
All right. Before we jump into In Case You Missed It, we have another word from our sponsor.
My name is Jeff Ranke. I'm the editorial director for Manufacturing.net, industrial equipment news, and manufacturing business technology. I'll be joined by Dave McGovern and James Engelhart from Obviously MDT to discuss various topics and provide takeaways on how you can be more efficient in the areas of OT data management control, version control, vulnerability protection, and much more. It's my pleasure to introduce Dave and Jim. Dave McGowan has 10 years of experience providing automation, change management, and disaster recovery solutions. He manages some of Obviously MDT's largest enterprise accounts and is especially passionate about helping customers implement the best OT backup and cybersecurity strategies. Jim Engelhart has been working in the controls world for 35 years. He has a BS in both chemical engineering and electrical engineering and has worked in the refining and chemical, engineering consulting, and food and beverage areas before settling in as head of pre-sales engineering, professional services, and support for the Americas at Obviously MDT. He's also a member of the Obviously MDT product team.
Hey, we're back. Just a reminder to download or watch right now, after the podcast is over, The Secrets of OT Data Management, an exclusive new video podcast for manufacturers from Obviously MDT and Jeff Ranke. Jeff, got to download. I mean, we're getting closer to the now, mm-hmm. but, you know, download this soon.
Yeah, sooner is better.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Get ahead. Competitive advantages.
That's
in
right.
This webinar.
Data management control, cybersecurity, shortcuts, and the more. That's what I find.
And
exciting.
Me.
And Jeff. More Jeff. Download it for more Jeff. All right. Well, let's get some more Jeff. In case you missed it.
There's a call to action.
Yeah. More Jeff. For more Jeff.
Said not many. Not many.
Well.
I'm not going to say no one. Not many.
Well, for In Case You Missed It, the stories that maybe not as popular on the website, but could make a big impact on the industry going forward. Let's get some more Jeff.
All right.
First. Jeff, what's here in case you missed it this week?
So I picked an article talking about e-waste from trashed electronic devices is piling up. In particular, we're looking at stuff with a plug or battery. The biggest violators are looking at cell phones, electronic toys, TVs, microwaves, e-cigarettes, laptops, computers, and even solar panels. According to the United Nations International Telecommunications Union and their research arm, they said there's about 62 million tons of e-waste being generated annually.
Incredible.
And by 2030, it's going to be up to 82 tons. That's enough to fill tractor trailers if they were lined up bumper to bumper to go around the world.
Ugh.
Now, this includes a lot of stuff like copper, gold, iron, other rare earth elements that we actually need and have recyclable value. But there's just not the recycling infrastructure in place to take advantage of all this electronic waste. Excuse me. So it's continuing to be a huge issue. There's obviously pollution issues. There's also issues because there's not a, in a lot of lesser developed countries, there's not a sanitary way of getting rid of a lot of this stuff. So it's sitting in huge trash heaps, which then scavengers are basically going through and trying to find these rare earths or these valuable metals to recycle. So it's just a combination of horrible pollution, human welfare, and really a huge missed opportunity. If you look at all the things that are out there to be recycled and reused that we need for stuff like lithium ion batteries for, you know, all those electric cars we're supposed to be driving here pretty quick. It just seems like this is a no-brainer in terms of somebody getting involved and really setting up infrastructure around the world from a global perspective and just offering people a place to get rid of this stuff, mm-hmm. an easy way to do it. Now, I understand it's hard to change human consumer behavior where they just want to throw stuff away.
Yeah.
But we need to continue to do more to educate, and we need to have somebody step up and really take charge of getting a hold of this stuff. I live in a community where we know this is where you go drop all this stuff off. And it's as simple as literally, I don't even have to get out of my car.
Yeah.
Okay. And I can just drop a bag full of stuff off, and I know it's getting recycled and you know, gotten rid of the right way without taking up a bunch of landfill, without putting people at risk, all of those things. So this just blew me away because it would seem at this point in our sort of development as a culture and as a society, we should figure out a way to reuse all this stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, the reality is we talk about this all the time. When it comes to consumer electronics, the lifetime of these products is shrinking constantly. We always want the newest, best. We're talking about TVs, you know, flat screen TVs not too long ago.
Yep.
A couple of years, they're done.
Yeah.
You know, that's just sort of a new norm that we've developed. But if that's going to be the new norm from a consumer perspective, we need to be responsible on the other end of that. Mm-hmm. Now, you can do all the regulatory stuff you want to. That's not, in my opinion, what's going to solve this. This needs to be somebody with some entrepreneurial skills stepping in and saying, man, let's take advantage of all this stuff.
Yeah.
And maybe set this person up with the right tools to do so, especially in all these smaller countries, especially when you look at China, who's responsible for something like 40% of all this electronic waste.
Yeah.
Got to get them involved. Got to start doing the right thing here.
No, I agree. Like the consumer electronics used to be like, what, 9 months is when you would turn over a typical consumer electronics. That's come down. And when you talk about those like e-cigarettes, that's a huge problem. Like, it's crazy that we're making disposable electronic devices and we don't really have an end game as to what happens to them, you know, once they're thrown away. You know, we have seen the Biden administration make like $100 million investment in recycling infrastructure because, you know, we've admitted like this is one of those areas where it's going to take a public-private partnership to maybe get some of it off the ground. The Department of Energy just gave like $375 million to a project. I believe it's Eastman they're working with. So there are some things in the mix, but you're right. Like as we're trying to get this off the ground, things are piling up and it's not unlimited resources.
Yeah.
Ben, your thoughts on sort of our e-waste problem and not really addressing it as fast as we should be.
Well, we're doing our part in the Munson household by just hanging on to all of our old electronics.
Oh, yeah.
Like this iPad fell in the bathtub. It's probably not going to work again, but maybe. So I'm going to keep it in a drawer just in case. We've got like ancient laptops. We've got all kinds of stuff. And we're just hanging on to them until the time comes when you can recycle them probably a little bit more easily. Or at least that's what I'm saying right now.
Because you're not a hoarder.
Right. I'm not a hoarder. I seem to remember there used to be like these like eco ATMs or something like that at the at the mall, and you could bring your old phone and they always wanted you to like plug the phone in and it had to actually like turn on. So it was like, are you going to recycle this or are you just trying to like resell it on
Direct?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I never really saw that as a viable option. Plus I don't want to like load up a bunch of old stuff and bring it to the mall.
What problems could that cause?
Yeah. So yeah, you're right. It needs to be easy. It needs to be convenient, and it needs to maybe even have like some sort of built-in like incentive for consumers. You know, mm-hmm. if there's value in this stuff, then maybe we should see a little bit of that. If if the lifespan is over, that doesn't necessarily mean, you know, we've gotten all the value out of it.
I mean, it only took a few cents to get people recycling cans. Mm-hmm. You know, just like we would pile our car full of crushed cans, cash it in for like $28, and it was just a windfall. Kids, you know? And I mean, I'm also responsible for this. But like, you know, Jeff, you say you live in a community that it's readily available to recycle or get rid of e-waste. In my community, it's not the same. We have 2 days a year where you can bring it in. And A, I had something go down the day after. And B, I'm guilty of the drawers full of stuff. But for me, it's like, you know what? One day I'm really going to take the time to plug everything in, get all the photos off of it, and then responsibly get rid of it. And that day has not come yet. So, and the drawer's not full of phones. So we're fine.
At least to Ben's point, it's not sitting in a landfill. He didn't throw it out in the trash.
Yeah.
Those are all things we can get better at.
Yeah. So, all right. From my, in case you missed it this week, I have a story that Anna filed before she took off for spring break and is coming back.
Just left us.
Yeah. Before she bailed. It was an interview with AMT, and the headline was, "A Recession Could Still Happen." The economy has everyone a little shaky, right? Some expected a full-blown recession, others a minor blip. Well, Anna recently interviewed Chris. Chris Chidzik, definitely not Chuck, principal economist for the Association for Manufacturing Technology. Many of us know it as AMT. AMT gives manufacturers vital information, like its monthly U.S. Manufacturing Technology Orders Report that tracks key industrial categories. Chidzik provided a little market insight that I found very valuable. For example, industrial companies have voiced concerns over a recession or a mild downturn in 2024. But Chidzik says things have changed. This quote caught me a little bit. He said, toward the middle of 2023, there were a lot of fears that a recession was around the corner. But as time went on, those fears really alleviated a lot. Whew, can all breathe, right? There's still a good chance that a recession might happen. Oh, God! But it is way less than before. Okay, I mean, this one just really put me through the ringer. Yeah. Chidzik cites a recent Bloomberg survey in which economists said there is still a 40% chance our economy could experience a recession within the next year. Still, that is the lowest it has been since 2022. I don't know if either of you guys had a chance to check out this piece that Anna put together. This is a very good one for in case you missed it. I don't know if because recession was in the headline, fault on me, or for whatever reason, but this one definitely fell under everyone's radar. And I thought there was a lot of really good information in here, Jeff.
I agree. And I think, one of the reasons that this one maybe didn't resonate as strongly as others is you've got a lot of forecasters, a lot of financial analysts out there who they're one way or the other.
Yeah.
They're polarizing in terms of the headlines. Things are awesome. Invest lots of money now, or you better sell everything because, you know, we're going to Mad Max times here in a matter of months. So, and I thought what was great here is Chidzik was very much, he was very rational and very real about stuff. He's like, look, things can always go sideways.
Yeah.
They can. And the reality is we're still, I know I've said this a lot, but we're still figuring out this post-pandemic supply chain dynamic in terms of how that affects supply and demand, how that affects pricing, how that affects wage rates. And that affects everything. It affects everything from the way, you know, when you can or how you manage childcare for your kids to grocery shopping to when you want to go on vacation, when you're going to buy a new car. And when that's the impact, it's hard to project exactly how things are going to go from a very broad financial perspective and how things are going to be within the economy. So I thought he was very, very insightful in terms of saying there's a lot of different factors we need to pay attention here to. Doesn't make sense to panic, but always be smart and be aware of all these changing dynamics that are around us.
Well, and another point that he made was that he talks about supply chain challenges, right? And whenever I think supply chain challenges, I think logistics and I think materials, right? And he said one of the biggest things that we should be watching right now is the labor shortage. Because, you know, Ben, sometimes it comes down to if you just don't have the people to make the thing, you can't sell the thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, it was a good, I thought it was a great interview. Did you have a chance to check this one out?
No, that's not true. I did probably have a chance to check it out, but I think I
vehemently ignored it.
I spaced on. I had so much to do. I'm so sorry, Anna, and I will watch it as soon as I get a chance. But I will say, I think there's something to what you said about just seeing the word recession in a headline can scare people off. A lot of people would prefer to kind of just kind of keep their head in the sand until it actually happens.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I agree that there's always indicators, and I like that this guy is taking kind of a common sense, data-driven approach to looking at what's happening rather than, you know, just speculating on, you know, market conditions right now.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's always scary to talk about a recession, and I don't think the general public typically kind of comprehends the, you know, what is all involved in
The intricacies of it. Yeah,
yeah.
No, it's you're right. He's an analyst that looks at the data, not the vibes is off. You know, some other things that he had mentioned that I just wanted to pull out. You know, there's been a lot of government investments, the Chips and Science Act, Inflation Reduction Act, bipartisan infrastructure law that have provided opportunities for industrial companies. And as a result, AMT has seen an uptick in manufacturing sector construction spending. Looking at machinery order data that AMT collected for its USMTO, the end of 2023 saw a massive uptick in activity for HVAC system manufacturers. And that one stuck out to me because I was like, I guess that's good for them. But according to Chidzik, these spikes generally indicate that construction is on the rise and about to be completed because, as he said, and I quote, if you're just laying a foundation, you don't need air conditioners yet. So I liked his very plain spoken analysis. He also says that more machinery will be in demand as these factories come online soon and start making things. So while there is still a chance, but less so, of a recession, things are looking good. And, you know, that's always positive.
That's a great indicator, too. I love that he's watching the HVAC system sales.
Yeah. Just, they're making more HVAC systems, and they got to be going somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Just, they're not banking them. All right. Ben, what's your In Case You Missed It this week?
Okay. Mine this week is Boom's supersonic jet flies for the first time. Boom's supersonic recently announced a successful first flight test of the XB-1, which the company referred to as the world's first independently developed supersonic jet. During the test, it met some early objectives like reaching an altitude of 7,000 feet and speeds of up to 273 miles per hour, which is not supersonic, I should point out.
Yeah, that's, so what, it's like a quarter of the way there?
I'm not an aerospace engineer, but I'm like, I could do that in my car.
Getting that car moving.
Could you?
Maybe not my car, but like a car. Yeah. The flight let Boom try out some new systems, like an augmented reality feature that combines video from front-mounted cameras with key flight data and then sends it to a high-resolution display for the pilot. But most importantly, the XB-1 represents kind of an important precursor to the Overture, which is what Boom is working on building right now and is hoping will be the fastest airliner in the world and kind of spark a return to the days of supersonic travel that was made possible by the Concorde, which has been retired for 20 years now, about the same time as the Streisand effect.
I appreciate the Streisand effect, man. Yeah. I like that is another nugget of trivia that I will tuck away and hopefully use at some other point.
Yeah. I think this is cool. The company they're progressing towards full scale production. They're lining up key suppliers and they're racking up more than like 100 orders from pretty major airlines like American and United. And when they're done, when they build this thing, it'll be able to hold, I think, up to 80 passengers. And then it'll be traveling about twice as fast as the current airliners on the market. And it'll be running on 100% sustainable aviation fuel. So I think it's really neat. But I'm also a little tentative about this, too, because I really foresee this being, you know, priced out of most people's ranges. I don't think, supersonic air travel is going to be something that's readily available to people in the near future.
No, I understand. And I understand the arguments about, this being 1% or transportation. And so people kind of say, like, why does it bother or why bother? I guess I hope that this is just, you know, like anything, right? Where it comes, a new technology comes out at a premium. Hopefully it realizes economies of scale. Mm-hmm. And then I have, you know, like this hope that maybe as, you know, we're jet setting to Arizona and snowbirding by the time I'm about to die, we can do that a little bit faster at an affordable price.
Yeah. I mean, you can already get a lot of places really quickly.
Yeah.
But if this is able to scale, it would make a huge difference. I mean, if you're able to go to Europe from like New York in 3 hours, that's...
Yeah, that'd be incredible.
Yeah, that's incredible.
So right now it's at about 35% of its way, 35% of the way to... supersonic speed.
Okay.
You know, I mean, that's good though.
Working on it.
Yeah, working on it. Jeff, your thoughts on, I mean, did you ever think when we first started covering Boom, did you ever think that they would even make it to this point?
You know, I mean, definitely they had a ton of challenges along the way. It's been interesting to see the company develop and morph. Two things that caught me here. I think, first of all, if they can continue with this same design, because it's really streamlined. I mean, looks like a mosquito.
Yeah.
I mean, if they can continue this as they scale up and make it bigger, it'll be really, really cool, very interesting looking aircraft. So that'll be something right there to just kind of keep your eye on. And I think the other thing that makes this a true thing that leads to the thing type of story is the use of the sustainable aviation fuel.
Oh, yeah.
Because that is something that we have the feedstock for in abundance. Mm-hmm. There is more oil that we can use for this fuel than we know what to do with. So if we can develop an infrastructure and an application for it where it can be used more widely, that might be the biggest benefit here. I agree with you, Ben. I think supersonic passenger air travel is a generation or so away. I mean, before we can really get it to the point where it's affordable and be able to use it in mass. Mm-hmm. But if we can develop systems like using SAF more universally and find more applications for it and develop a way of getting it to the usage point, that's huge. That's enormous.
Let's fly faster and cleaner.
Yeah. Think how much old grease you can burn while going that fast.
What's that smell?
Yes.
Let's get on to our final thoughts before we get out of here. Ben, first of all, thank you very much for joining us again today. Really appreciate having you on, man. What's your final thought?
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's been fun. I'm just thinking about spring break. I'm going to kind of technically start one tomorrow. I never did a full spring break like party thing in college, but I have had a few years where I got to go somewhere a lot warmer than it is here right now.
Yeah.
And I think everybody deserves to enjoy nice weather during spring break. So if you're enduring crappy weather like me this year, just know that you deserve more. we all do. All right.
Yeah. Okay. I will remember that as I stay here. No. Well, I hope you get a chance to at least enjoy your abbreviated spring break, man.
Thanks.
You have big plans?
Yeah, going to Milwaukee where the weather is just as bad.
Yeah. We're going to get closer to the big lake.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe with the lake effect, it might be a little milder.
Yeah.
Maybe.
I think we'll stay in a hotel with a pool. So that's something.
We're going to pretend we're summer warmer.
Yeah.
Well, very good. I hope you guys have a great time. My final thought this week is that, as I sort of mentioned earlier, I did recently have to replace a piece of e-waste. My DVD player went down on me. And I know everyone's just like, well, do you have a DVD player? And it's like, because I still invest in physical media because
darn
it's
right.
Important.
I'm with you there.
So I bought a new DVD player. And I sent an image of this to Alex. I don't know if we can bring it up now, but we'll make sure it's on the video feed. As I'm taking the new DVD player out of the box, I like turn it upside down to just because it's easier to open from the bottom, right? And it just says, warning, cancer. That's all it says. Whoa. And I was just like, what now? Because, you know, and then I like kind of skeptically plug it in. I'm just like, so I understand, just because we have a little bit more of a knowledge of the industry, that this is the state of California mandated, like, what is it, like Prop P65 warning or whatever, where the warning is supposed to say something like, minimally, this product contains a chemical known to the state of California to cause cancer. But for most people that are trying to just put a simple DVD player in, which is completely still necessary, it might be a little startling to just read warning cancer. So, like, I mean, this could be loosely interpreted as, like, you know, when I sat down to watch Boiling Point starring Wesley Snipes last night, I mean, maybe the...
Wow.
Nice. Yeah, it's solid. Pull.
Is the DVD player just kind of saying, like, after you're done watching your movie or whatever, don't forget to think about cancer.
Yes, because you'll likely have it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I understand that these warnings exist for a reason. Maybe just add a few more words on the packaging to maybe provide at least a little, I mean, a little bit of peace of mind. There was a URL there, but like, you don't just need to say that. Just a little more. Like,
I do feel like I need to ask this though, given your sort of legacy of purchases.
Yeah.
Was this like a name brand DVD or was this kind of like,
it was a name brand
superstore off brand at a rummage sale?
No. Man, actually, if you could get a DVD player at a rummage sale, they probably got a quality product right there. But no, it was definitely a more economic purchase because I needed something that fit a smaller footprint. Because it like sits on top of a, I'm going to fall over, sits on top of like a, what's it, a jewelry?
Armoire.
Yeah. Jewelry
sure.
thing.
Yeah. I went to Shopko.
Yeah. So you're right. No, I wasn't going big spender because also like the TV in our room was like, I don't know, small.
Sure.
I don't need ultra HD to watch.
Well, I could see you getting like, it doesn't even say DVD player on it. It's like,
disc
DVD
player.
Type player device or something, yeah. You know?
Yeah, disc player.
Media well, placement.
Yeah. Eric's final thought. It's good that producer Eric has one. He says 79 and sunny right now in Destin.
We don't care, Eric.
Is Destin a real place or is he just forgetting the why? Is he in Destin?
I think he's in Destin, Florida.
Oh, okay. Okay. It's odd that he made that his destination for spring break. Jeff, your final thought?
I'm going to save the final thought I had for next week when Anna is here.
Oh, but all right.
Ben did inspire me a little bit. You know, you're talking about spring break. The big thing is, especially, you know, your daughter's getting older and stuff like that. One of the best spring breaks I had, I actually took my kids to Chicago. Oh. And one of the memories is just waiting to get into the aquarium because I got there too soon and got there before it opened and did not anticipate the rush of people who would have the same idea. So we were standing outside the Sheds Aquarium for a good 2 hours.
Oh, no. Oh,
and the girls were really, yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, you're right on the lake. I mean, it was brisk.
Yeah.
Thankfully, there was a hot dog vendor there. We got some awesome hot dogs. We made a decent time, but it was a great memory.
Yeah.
And going down there and doing that. So you don't always have to go, you know, hot weather-wise to have some fun.
We were there in March, and the walk from the parking lot was bitter cold. It was just like, and the wind's coming off the lake, so half of your face is just gone and the other half is like, I'll go to, I don't
know, I'm slowly going.
Yeah, I also want to leave. Yeah.
I mean, you would think that the Shedd Aquarium would have the foresight to be like, oh, it's spring break, maybe have two people tearing tickets. I don't know.
Yeah. So
it's not up to them. It's up to the fish.
They run the show.
Yeah.
All right. Well, before we get out of here, please make sure to like, share, and subscribe to the podcast. You could also help us out a lot by leaving the podcast a positive review on whatever platform you use. If you want to email the podcast, you can reach any of us at Jeff, David, or Ben at IEN.com with email the podcast in the subject line. You could also subscribe to our daily newsletter. Make sure you get it delivered to your inbox first. Hit that thumbs up button on YouTube. Jack, do us a favor. Thank you. And thank you to everybody who also joined us live. Producer Eric, hit that thumbs up. You better. You're invested. You have a reason to hit the button.
It's okay.
I'm just saying. You should do it. Also, producer Eric and Anna, hope you guys are enjoying your spring break, and we'll see you again soon. All right. For Jeff Franke and Ben Munson, I'm David Manti. This is the Today in Manufacturing podcast, and we'll see you next week.